A glimpse of life during war in Sudan's capital, Khartoum. Just meeting day-to-day needs like getting bread brings the risk of running into the wrong soldier.
At that moment, I thought that he was going to shoot me as well, because if he shot the first time, he could shoot again.
Also ahead, in West Africa, sea levels are visibly rising.
Growing up, we had to walk very far to have the ocean. But now, because of climate change, right now we have the sea very close to the houses.
Plus, some Russians in Serbia are watching what they say. They oppose Putin's war in a country that supports the Kremlin.
If we start saying something here, maybe we will lose one more nice place to live.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. That's all ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler in for Marco Werman. Thanks for joining us. Everyone today is talking about the same thing, the weather, the heat, the rain that's triggering floods, the wildfire smoke. Across the globe, deadly weather is wreaking havoc. Japan and India are overwhelmed with flooding. Heat waves are stretching across the U.S., Europe, and China, with temperature records being shattered. And wildfires continue to blaze across Canada. In each of these places, frontline responders are working to save lives and property. Lily Caprani is chief of advocacy at UNICEF. Lily, what are some of the places that UNICEF is working on climate-related disasters right now?
The sad thing is that because UNICEF is the biggest UN children's agency, we're responding to climate disasters all over the world, and it's almost too many to begin to list. You know, as you said, we've got unprecedented heat waves and droughts across the Horn of Africa and beyond, and unprecedented levels of flooding. And what we're seeing is the number of climate-driven and climate-exacerbated humanitarian disasters going up. Since 2015, there's three times as many people in the world who need humanitarian help. It's really that widespread.
So when, like right now, there are multiple disasters happening at once all around the world, how do you prioritize where to send resources, which are, of course, you know, limited, finite?
Well, that is the challenge, is that responding to humanitarian emergencies is very expensive. And of course, the more and more disasters that we have to respond to, the more stretched the whole humanitarian system is becoming. And UNICEF tries to take a very principled approach, which is that we should prioritize sending money to the places with the greatest amount of need, and not just to the more popular or high profile places. There is sometimes the risk that certain countries don't get as much attention, and then they go without some of the support that they need.
So has UNICEF's strategy had to change or shift as climate change makes these extreme events more common? I mean, are we entering a new way of doing humanitarian response?
Well, yes. I mean, we're responding to the kinds of disasters that are increasing in frequency, but also in how long they last. We're having to stay for much longer over much more intense periods. You probably remember that there were extreme floods last year in Pakistan, and they lasted for such a long time that 500,000 people were living in refugee camps. They were displaced from their homes, 2 million homes damaged. So that's the kind of long-term response. It's not just about a sudden weather event. It's about the long-term impacts. So we're having to stay and deal with the long-term effects of these climate disasters. But what we're trying to do, and how we want to change the way we operate, is do more of the kind of preventative work where we can get in and build stronger systems where communities have the resilience to deal with climate emergencies.
So increased attention on preparedness, resilience. You also mentioned, though, staying in a place that needs assistance longer. Can you give an example of, you know, how that changes UNICEF's operations or what that might mean for you know, what kind of resources you have to deploy on the ground?
Yeah, I mean, a good example is you can have sudden weather events like cyclones or floods, but more often we see these slow burn emergencies, like, for example, droughts. In the Horn of Africa, we've got unprecedented droughts where we've had failed harvests, failed rainy seasons, and therefore an ability to grow food crops year after year. And because it's been a sustained drought period, the food system starts to struggle, and we see rising rates of malnutrition. So we have to plan for the long term, and we can do it more effectively when we anticipate it. The most important thing we can do is be ready to go and reduce the response time. That's how you save the most lives when a disaster does happen.
So right now, with the extreme weather we're facing, flooding, heat, drought, what kind of aid are you deploying into the field right now at this moment?
We're working in countries all over the world, across major drought areas, across the Horn of Africa, for example, in Somalia, South Sudan, Kenya, where extreme drought has been driving up the rates of child malnutrition for the last year or two. We're working with communities in Pakistan who have been displaced by the floods there, making sure that children still get access to learning, that they still get access to immunization, that they get access to all of the basic healthcare that can keep them thriving and learning. This is not just limited to low-income countries, of course. Even in the middle-income and higher-income countries, extreme heat stress from heat waves that are more intense and lasting longer can also pose threats to pregnant women, to very young babies and other vulnerable groups. And so we're working with the healthcare systems, with doctors and nurses, to help them anticipate those risks, spread the word about how to protect yourself against heat stress, and make sure that they're ready to respond and treat pregnant mums and babies that are affected by extreme heat.
Does it feel like the pace of your work is changing due to climate change?
There is absolutely no doubt. Of all of the work that UNICEF does around the world and all of the countries we work in, the number of humanitarian crises that we respond to, the number of them, the intensity of them, the duration of them is increasing. And that's not going to change anytime soon. So we are going to have to find ways to increase the amount of resilience work that's done to prevent this kind of constant exponential rise in the costs of responding to humanitarian emergencies.
I'm hearing from a good number of people who are maybe overwhelmed by all the news of all this extreme weather this summer, a bit scared. Are there any lessons or advice that you have for people who are maybe confronting this reality really for the first time?
For the last few years, many of us have heard about climate change and thought that it was a future problem that we would hopefully be able to find a way out of. And it's true that there is still so much the world can do to reduce carbon emissions and reduce the worst impacts of climate change. But I do think it's starting to sink into people's minds that actually it's already happening. In some ways, it's good that we're all beginning to realize that this is a real problem that we all have to deal with. I would say it's right to be anxious about it because it is an urgent problem that we all need to tackle. But we do have very clear climate science telling us what needs to happen. It's not that we don't have the knowledge and some of the emerging technologies and ways ahead. It will require a lot of political will and some urgent action, but it's not an impossible problem to solve.
Lily Caprani is Chief of Advocacy at UNICEF. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
More than 1 million Russians have fled their country since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022. Unlike Ukrainian refugees, Russians often struggle to find welcoming places, especially in Europe. But one country has embraced them: Serbia. Serbia and Russia have close ties, and many Serbs support the Russian invasion. As the world's Jerry Haddon reports, that puts anti-war Russians who fled to the capital of Belgrade in an awkward position.
There's a joke among Russians fleeing Vladimir Putin's war about how few countries will accept them. They just hold their red Russian passport high in the air, like a soccer ref giving a red card, sending the player packing.
Actually, we feel like all Europe doesn't like us.
That's 27-year-old Arina Piskarova, a Russian who fled St. Petersburg weeks after the invasion of Ukraine began. She now lives here in Belgrade, works at this tiny Russian-owned cafe called 53. She left Russia because she opposes the war, and that puts her in an odd position here. She's welcomed as a Russian, but at the same time, she says, she feels uneasy because of her anti-war stance in a country where many people support it. This was a huge pro-Russia march in downtown Belgrade last year. Tens of thousands of Serbs chanted their support for Vladimir Putin's war. It's happened more than once since the start of the full-scale invasion. The marches haven't come as a surprise. Serbia and Russia are traditional allies. Serbia was part of Yugoslavia in the Soviet Union. The two countries share a common Slavic heritage. Piskarova says most Serbs embrace Russians like brothers and sisters, until you tell them you're against the war.
A lot of us came here, left our families, who are saying that we betrayed the country. And maybe we don't want to face this again. So we're just not talking about it with someone we don't know.
Piskarova says she and other Russian dissidents fear that if they get too political, they could get that metaphorical red card.
If we start saying something here, maybe we will lose one more nice place to live. And we will have only China left for us.
China hasn't condemned Putin's war. Serbia only did so after weeks of strong-arming by the U.S. and the European Union. Serbia is on the EU waiting list, which gives Brussels some leverage. So Serbia is a complicated place for Russians speaking out against the war. Take 34-year-old Russian Sasha Seregina. She's lived in Belgrade for more than a decade. She says when the latest invasion began, she went out to protest.
I realized that there will be a spontaneous gathering in front of the Russian embassy in Belgrade. So this is how I found myself there with like a few dozens of other people from Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and Serbia.
Since then, Seregina says far-right Serb extremists have been harassing her and other protesters online.
So they were targeting particular random people on the protest, insulting them, writing fake stuff, derogatory stuff about them. And I believe this is the kind of the old KGB tactics, actually, like to target random people just to make others fear, you know.
Seregina says in her case, it hasn't worked. And as the war drags on, she notes, the initial pro-Russia fervor among some Serbs appears to be dying down. When the 2022 invasion began, Serbian street vendors were making a small fortune selling I Heart Putin t-shirts, hats and keychains emblazoned with the Russian flag. Today, such paraphernalia is hard to find. Over a couple of days in downtown Belgrade, I only spot one item for sale, a coffee mug with Putin's face on it. How much for the mug, I asked the seller. $5, he says. Do a lot of people buy them? Some do, some don't, he says. I'm not selling many these days. Fewer Putin mugs, fewer pro-Putin demonstrations. As the pro-war fervor subsides, in public at least, it's leaving room for some anti-war Russians to be more open about their views. That includes artists. In a public art space near Belgrade's riverfront, a Russian modern dancer named Olga is warming up before rehearsal. Olga doesn't want to give her last name as her parents are still in Vladivostok in Russia's Far East. She says she doesn't want to get them into trouble. Olga's been in Belgrade since 2018, but was teaching and performing in Scotland when the full-scale invasion started. Even though she spoke out publicly against the war, her hosts canceled her shows just because of her citizenship.
What they said, it's about my safety, because you never know who will come and like how people will react. It was upsetting. It was upsetting because, yes, I'm against it, and I kind of openly say about it.
Olga didn't exactly get that red card, but she was forced to come back to Belgrade. When she did, she says, she was surprised to find a newly arrived community of like-minded fellow citizens.
I met a lot of Russians just fleeing Russia and coming here, which was, at first, it was very, like, strange. At some point, I realized that I'm hearing Russian language on the streets more often than English or Serbian.
Many of those fleeing are artists. Today, Olga is rehearsing with a Russian video artist, along with a Serbian dancer and a Serbian composer. She's still unabashedly against the war and doesn't give it a second thought.
I think pro-Russian, pro-Putin people are mostly older generations, but my generation, younger, all against, especially the arts community.
And through collaborations like this, she says, the community is making their stance known. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Belgrade, Serbia.
Just ahead, one man from Khartoum describes what it's like living in Sudan's capital when warring sides are patrolling your neighborhood and each errand is filled with danger. You're listening to The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. You're listening to The World. Since the fighting began in Sudan in mid-April, more than 2 million people have fled their homes, searching for safety as the Sudanese army and the rapid support forces fight over territory. In the capital city, Khartoum, that turf war is neighborhood by neighborhood, block by block. Khartoum resident Mubarak Adil stayed in the city as long as he could. He spent a month and a half living in a kind of siege mode, until finally he had enough run-ins and near misses with the warring sides. He's now displaced, living in another part of Sudan. Adil recently told his story to The World's Marco Werman.
Mubarak, back in April when the fighting started, where were you and what were you doing?
The first few days were really strange because there was lack of information about what's exactly going on and how long this is going to last. And one of the first worries was obviously getting shot or random bullets flying by. There was even a couple of bullets that hit our home, but thankfully no one got hurt.
So at a certain point, food runs out and your daily mission was basically trying to find water and flour for bread, right?
Yes, exactly.
Was it clear to you who was controlling your neighborhood and who you were basically responding to?
The first days we didn't know who was controlling which areas, but we did see a lot of RSF forces on the ground where we lived.
So you knew the reputation of the RSF, and when you're out looking for bread in these dangerous parts of Khartoum, did you ever run into the RSF?
I was with my cousin. The same day we were looking for bread, we found a gun that was laying on the ground.
A gun just lying on the ground like that?
Yeah, it was completely strange and weird to find a firearm just laying on the ground. My cousin actually picked it up, and we didn't know what to do. At first, to be honest, we didn't get the time to search and discover whether it was loaded or not, because it was in the middle of the street and we were afraid that someone is going to see us.
So your cousin, Abdul Rahim, what did he do with the gun?
I see. Well, he actually tried to hide it in an empty bag of chips he found in the ground.
Like potato chips?
Potato chips, yeah. So he was carrying a gun while walking through a place that was full of RSF soldiers.
Yeah, so then what happened? Did you run into any RSF fighters?
We ran into one of them, one of the RSF forces. He was holding a gun, an AKM, and immediately pointed at us the moment he saw us. And immediately started accusing us of working with the army intelligence.
What did your cousin do with the gun?
Yeah, the gun was the biggest concern for us. If he did see us carrying a gun, he would not hesitate killing us. So my immediate reaction was to try to get him to be calm, like we are just civilians, we are just minding our own business.
De-escalate the situation.
De-escalate the situation, yes, exactly. And I was trying to get his attention so he would not focus with my cousin and the gun that was in his potato chips. So every time he was circling around my cousin, I would try to get his attention, ask him to let us leave, because if he did see the gun with my cousin, we are through. We are done for.
And so did your strategy of kind of distracting this RSF fighter, did that work?
To some extent, yeah, it did work. The RSF fighter did not see the gun that was with us, but he did focus with my cousin that because he had dreadlocks. He asked him whether he was a boy or a girl because he had dreadlocks.
And what happened then?
Then he tried to cut his hair. That was after he was sure that we are just civilians and we are not part of the intelligence. He was still trying to hurt us. He was still trying to cut my cousin's hair. And at that moment, my cousin, I think he panicked and just immediately ran away.
He ran away? I mean, how did the RSF fighter react to that?
He immediately pointed his AKM at him and shot a bullet. Luckily, my cousin took the nearest turn and the bullet didn't shoot him.
Got it. So he ran around the corner and survived. You're standing there next to this RSF fighter. He's lifting up his weapon and aiming at your cousin. What were you thinking and feeling, Mubarak?
To be honest with you, Marco, that was one of the scariest moments of my life. I literally just stood in shock because everything happened so fast. Because he was sure that he was a civilian. I did not expect him to shoot a bullet at him.
Did the RSF fighter direct any anger toward you at that point?
Yes. The minute he was sure that he was not able to catch my cousin, he pointed his gun at me and took me as a hostage. And at that moment, I thought that he was going to shoot me as well. Because if he shot the first time, he could shoot again, you know?
Yeah.
He took me to, as a hostage, and we walked about a mile, leading me to their detention center. My hands were up in the air, and he was standing behind me. One wrong move could possibly end my life.
Yeah.
So I was trying to convince him that we are just civilians. And when he asked me, why did my cousin run away? I told him simply he panicked. He saw that you were going to bring a knife to cut his hair, and he thought that we were going to kill him. At that moment, the RSF fighter was really quiet. And to be honest, I thought that he was going to execute me at that moment. So I just said my prayers and waited for it to end. He had a change of heart and decided to let me go. He gave me 10 seconds to disappear out of his sight. So naturally, I ran like hell. I ran so fast to not get shot at.
Yeah. Wow, what an intense story. I just want to draw our attention to the crying child in back of you. I mean, you're not in Khartoum anymore. And as a lot of people know, when people are on the move and not stable, these are the situations you end up in, squatting in other places. Tell me about actually leaving Khartoum, Abar, because you had one bad run-in with the RSF. Easily possible that that would happen again when you're leaving.
There were several checkpoints that were on our way. They immediately stopped us, and they were trying to get us to leave the car. But luckily, one of the fighters, recognized my father.
Incredible. And?
Apparently, he was the guard for my father's company. And apparently, my father treated him well.
Wow. Incredible. I mean, so often, it's about luck, the difference between those who survive and those who don't. Mubarak, thank you very much for sharing your story, and good luck carrying on to you, your father, and your cousin.
The World's Marco Werman talking with Mubarak Adil, who was a resident of Khartoum until recently when the fighting in Sudan forced him to flee. One man's experience in a war that has killed thousands and displaced millions. You're listening to The World. Cricket is huge globally. Not quite so much in the U.S., but today a new professional league debuts in Dallas.
Expect pure action, pure entertainment, a lot of sixes or home runs, as you would call it in baseball. It's fun, it's flavorful.
Courting a wider U.S. audience for cricket, that's ahead on The World. I'm Carolyn Buehler. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Russia is throwing thousands of Ukrainian civilians into prisons. It's putting many of them to work digging trenches, fortifications, and graves not far from the front lines. Others are being sent to jails deep inside Russia. It's all part of a vast, grim gulag system, which the Associated Press has detailed in a new investigation. AP correspondent Lori Hinnant played a central role in that. Lori, tell us about this massive incarceration network that's holding Ukrainian civilians. It sounds like people are being held in, you know, what we think of as prisons and also in informal jails and work camps. What does it look like?
Well, it looks like a lot of different things, and a network is almost too structured a word for what it is. But the detention of Ukrainian civilians dates back to the very first days of the war, when Russia had lists of people that they wanted to hunt down and detain, people at the time that they thought might be influential in public opinion, people who they thought might actively resist an occupation. And then the system expanded to include teachers and doctors who refused to work for them. And then it just started to sweep up a whole lot of other people, really for minor infractions, such as seen by the Russians as infractions, speaking Ukrainian, or just being a young Ukrainian male at the wrong place at the wrong time. So you end up with these formal prisons in Russia where some are taken, and then you have these really informal places referred to pretty much universally by Ukrainians as basements. And they are just where people are held, they're tortured, and they never know necessarily why or what they need to do to get free.
Some of the Ukrainian civilians you've reported on are also forced to do manual labor for the Russians. What kind of work are they being forced to do?
Well, this was one of the more chilling things that we came across, were people who were forced to dig trenches for the Russian army. And they're doing so near the front lines, in some cases, wearing oversized Russian military uniforms because they were taken from their homes with nothing. So these people were dressed in Russian soldiers' uniforms, which means that a Ukrainian surveillance drone flying over them digging the trench is going to see Russian soldiers when, in fact, they're Ukrainian civilians.
Hmm. You found that torture in these prisons is widespread, whether or not there is intelligence that the guards hope to gather. Can you tell me more about that?
The torture was one of these things that every single person spoke of. The tools that were used were the same, really, no matter what part of the country, what part of occupied Ukraine was mentioned. And we obtained police evidence photos of nearly 100 instruments of torture uncovered after particular territories were liberated. Every single thing was the same. It was like there was a playbook.
How did you find all this out? What kind of evidence do you have?
In addition to the police evidence photos that we've been collecting over months, we spoke to around 20 freed civilian captives, freed or people who managed to get their way out in the case of the occupied territories. We spoke to human rights activists from both Russia and Ukraine, as well as government officials.
I want to ask you about two specific people you wrote about, Artem Baranov, a security guard, and Yevhen Prishliak, who worked at a local asphalt plant. Can you tell me their story?
So they were friends. They became close during the pandemic because they both bought dogs at the same time. Mm. One night, they were out walking their dog. This is when their town fell under occupation. They were out walking their dogs and realized that they were getting very close to curfew. And so Yevhen decided to stay at Artem's apartment rather than being caught out during curfew. Neighbors later told their families that 15 armed Russian soldiers came in, ransacked the apartment, and grabbed them. So for a month, they were held in their local jail. So Baranov's wife was able to visit the jail. She could talk to Yevhen through the fence, but he told her that Artem couldn't come out. So she sent in packages of food. She never knew if they got to him. Finally, on his birthday, she sent in a package of cream eclairs because it was his favorite dessert. And she did something really clever. She smashed them all up. And inside the smashed pastry, she slipped in her new Russian phone number. She had no idea if it had gotten to him. She was hoping that by smashing up the pastries, it would discourage any guards from stealing them. Finally, 4 months later, she gets a message from a prison in Russia through a man that she didn't know. His name was Pavel Zaporizhets, and he was charged with international terrorism, which means he actually had a lawyer. And his lawyer had her phone number because Artem had memorized it. So this is when she finally knew 4 months later that her package had gotten through. So Artem tells her that he lost track of where his friend Yevhen had gotten to after their third transfer or so. Since then, there's been very little news. He sometimes has written his family, and they're just waiting. There's no charges. They're just hoping to find out how to reach these men, how to essentially understand what the allegations are against them.
The hope for many of those held in Russian jails is to be part of a prisoner exchange. That is even though international law forbids the exchange of civilians as prisoners of war, right? So how are these captives managing to find a way out?
Well, in terms of the exchanges, this is nothing that Ukraine is seeking because you can't exchange soldiers for civilians. It is against all laws of war. And this is just something that when it happens, these people show up and they obviously are not going to reject them. But it's also not a way to get systematically large numbers of people freed because Russia has so many civilian captives. And so right now, there's a real conundrum for the Ukrainian government and for the families of the missing, because for most cases, they have no idea where they are. In a handful of cases, there's at least limited communication via the Red Cross. but no real legal mechanism. They don't have anything in the way of standing under Russian law, except for the few who are actually charged.
That's Associated Press reporter Lori Hennant. She's part of the AP team that's investigating Russia's detention system incarcerating thousands of Ukrainian civilians. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Warming temperatures have been driving up sea levels for years, but a recent study suggests the impact may be even greater than predicted. Around 200 million people could be displaced by flooding and shoreline erosion in the next few decades, according to the UN. Problems created by sea level rise are particularly worrisome across West Africa, where 8 in 10 people live on the Atlantic coast. The world's Tibisay Seya reports from one community in Senegal.
The city of Saint-Louis in northern Senegal sits between the Senegal River and the Atlantic Ocean. During colonial times, it was the administrative capital of French West Africa. The city center is a UNESCO World Heritage Site, full of colorful architecture. It's also home to an ancient and still vibrant fishing village called Wet Nda. Following the afternoon prayer, young people get together to play soccer or volleyball at the beach. One group of kids is having fun chasing some sheep and goats. This beach is where Cheikh Badian grew up. He speaks Wolof, the local language, and he's wearing a long traditional shirt called anungu. Badian is a retired fisherman. He lives nearby with his children and grandchildren, who also fish for a living.
He says, the only wealth we have is our boys. They are the future fishermen when we retire.
Speaking through an interpreter, Badian tells me he's hoping to spend the rest of his life taking it easy here on the beach. But he might not be able to do so, because the waters that provided him a living as a fisherman are threatening the existence of the whole village.
Growing up, what we used to see is not what we're seeing today. We had to walk very far to have the ocean. But now, because of climate change, right now we have the sea very close to the houses. It was not like this when we were growing up.
He says 50 or 60 years ago, the water was half a mile away. Now it washes up to the houses on the shore, sometimes pouring through the windows. In 2018, a high tide event destroyed many houses, mosques, and schools here. About 1,500 people were forced to move to a displacement camp funded by the United Nations.
We do not want to leave because this is what we know, this is what we have, the sea and the fresh air.
Badian says his house was not destroyed at that time, but he was notified by local authorities that the family might have to relocate soon.
So we've decided to become a coalition and stand strong against the government who wants to take us away from here.
But the authorities say everyone will eventually have to go.
It's estimated that in West Africa, over 40 million people in these lowest-lying zones will be exposed to sea level rise by 2030.
That's Mark Dirksen from the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. He says some of the biggest and fastest-growing cities in Africa are on the coast and vulnerable to rising seas.
And it's an open question whether they will all survive and find strategies to host all the people who want to live and work along these bustling shorelines.
He says frequent flooding, storms, and coastal erosion are destroying natural barriers such as wetlands, coastal dunes, and barrier islands.
This is compounded in many African cities where there are weak environmental protections and significant shortages of existing and affordable housing.
The Diougop displacement camp is inland, about 5 miles from the fishing village. Thousands of people have been living here since 2018. The tents all look identical, white walls, blue roof, and little plastic windows. There are almost no trees, and everything is surrounded by sand.
Yes, we are here, but that's not what we truly want, because the beach side is better.
Silo Bufal and her family have lived here for 4 years. She says the relentless heat is the worst part of it.
No,
She says, we don't have electricity. They are already dead because of the heat. Nobody can go in the tents before 10 p.m.
In the next few years, about 15,000 more fishermen and their families are expected to move into the area. The city government of San Luis has promised to find a permanent housing solution nearby and to provide shuttle buses for fishermen to reach the coast. But Seilo Bufal tells me she and her family just don't see a future for themselves here. She says she's been thinking about getting on a smuggling boat and trying to make it to the Canary Island in Spain, like many of her neighbors have already done. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isaiah, Saint Louis, Senegal.
Okay, pop quiz here. Soccer is the world's most popular sport. What's number two? That would be cricket. It's not huge here in the U.S., but today Major League Cricket is launching.
That's a no ball, and that's a six!
A taste of what's to come there. Some similarities to baseball, but some differences too. Nikhil Uttamchandani is one of the commentators for the new U.S. League and joins us from Dallas, where the first game is tonight. Are you excited?
Yeah, massively excited, Carolyn. It's a revolutionary time for the sport of cricket, not only in the United States, but I would say in the world. I look at the United States being the second largest sports market. I think both of them coming together, cricket and the USA, I think is a match made in heaven, and I'm so excited.
So tell us about the league. How many teams are they? Where are they located?
So there'll be six teams competing in this first edition of the Major League. We have the Washington Freedom. You have the MI New York side. You've also got the LA Knight Riders. You've got Texas Super Kings, who those two will be facing off in the first match later today. And then I think the other two are the San Francisco Unicorns and the Seattle Orcas.
And where are the players from? Are they from the U.S. or are they from places where more cricket is already played?
So you would see a lot of the players. There's international and there's domestic players. Each team must play five domestic players. And domestic players will include those that are born in the USA. There is a couple in terms of US-born. Steven Taylor was the first to be picked in the draft of a USA-born player. There's also Noshus Kenjige, who's from Alabama. Both play for the USA international team. But then you also move down the spectrum and you have someone like Ali Khan, who's played a lot of cricket for the USA. He moved from Pakistan at 18 years old.
So we've said cricket is super popular around the world, especially in former British colonies like Pakistan and India and across the Caribbean. So who's playing it here in the U.S. now? And, you know, how did the game come to the U.S. in the first place?
Yeah, well, actually, a lot of people think cricket has only now come to the USA. But the first international match ever was played in Manhattan between the USA and Canada. So it's almost always been there or thereabouts. I don't think it's been to this scale. The main people playing it and that have brought it and have elevated it to this level has been the diaspora. A lot of Indians who've moved to the USA. I know a lot of West Indians as well, especially in places like New York, have come over to the USA and have obviously brought their culture, have brought the sport. And then, of course, had children here. Their children go on to take on the culture and then go on to play cricket.
Cricket in England was lambasted recently in a formal report that called the sport racist, sexist, and classist. Will those problems also be taking root here in U.S. cricket? Is that possible to avoid?
I don't think so. As we mentioned before, it is so much diversity. It is diaspora. It is people of all walks of life who've come together and almost unified just by this sport of cricket. But I think that's the beauty of the sport. It just brings people together constantly. And because of that, and I look at the USA team as well, you have West Indian-born players, you have Indian players, you have Pakistani players, and I don't think you could look anywhere around the world and see people born in different countries all playing on one team and all coming together for one common goal.
So I think a stereotype of cricket here in the U.S. For people who don't know so much about it is that it is slow. There are tea breaks. What's your best sales pitch for, you know, someone who has never watched a full game before to maybe start paying attention?
That was a problem with cricket because the longest format goes over 5 days. But the format that will be played in the Major League is called T20. And a T20 game on average will last 3 to 3.5 hours. And you're guaranteed to see something every single ball. Each innings will be 120 balls. And it's pure action. A lot of sixes, a lot of wickets. And I mean, if you think baseball is fun and captivating, where when the ball goes behind the batter, it's almost out of bounds. That doesn't happen in cricket. Every time something happens, it counts. It makes a difference to the overall score and in turn impacts the overall result. So what I would tell that prospective viewer is that to come to give cricket a chance, but expect pure action, pure entertainment.
So no tea breaks?
No tea breaks.
Nikhil Uttamchandani is one of the commentators for Major League Cricket. The league's first game is tonight in Dallas. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
As Venezuela's economic and political situation has worsened, that country has seen an exodus. Over the past decade, a staggering 7 million people have left. This week on Movement, our series about music and migration, host Macleet Hedero has the story of an unlikely musical duo born out of that mass migration.
Lari Bellorin walks into the studio with a cowboy hat and cowboy boots, lugging a massive harp. Right behind him is Joe Troop in a silky embroidered shirt with a banjo slung over his shoulder.
It's rolling? Cool.
Right away, they are ready to play. Lari is a legendary performer of Venezuelan llanera music, who migrated to North Carolina to make a better life for his family. Joe is a lightning, fingerpick, and bluegrass man who fell in love with llanera music after a decade of living in Latin America. Together, these two are a sum is greater than its parts kind of team. There's so many things I want to talk about. I read that you were doing construction for a time, and this ensemble is how you've come back to music.
Sí. Cuando llegué aquí, que entré a trabajar construcción.
When I first got here and I started working in construction.
En la primera semana, como el tercer día.
Like in the first week, on the third day.
Había un frío, pero riquísimo. Me encanta el frío.
It was beautifully, wonderfully cold. I love cold.
Pues sí, como el oso.
Like a happy little bear.
Entonces estaba trabajando.
I was trying to put a block in the right place.
Un compañero estaba arriba.
One of my coworkers was above me, and I was below.
Le digo, no vayas a soltar la ta. La soltó.
And as I was about to place it, I said, please don't drop the ta. And he dropped it.
El resto de la palabra lo hizo la misma tapa.
And the end of the word was completed by the same block. Oh, top, yeah, top block.
Y esta uña se arrancó.
And my nail got ripped off.
Ese frío.
And in that cold.
El dolor era.
And the pain.
Increíble.
Was incredible.
Yo que me dolía todo el cuerpo de lo que sentía.
Hurt my entire body.
Y eso afectó mucho emocionalmente mi persona.
And that really emotionally affected my person because.
Si hay algo que yo he cuidado en mi vida.
Because if there's one thing I've taken care of in my life.
Han sido mis manos.
It was my hands.
Sí.
Y cuando miré esto, no lloraba por fuera. O sea, por dentro estaba desgarrado.
And when I took a look at my hand, I didn't cry on the outside, but inside I was sobbing.
O sea, decía, se acabó.
It's like it's over.
Ya no más música.
There's no more music.
Solo puse un pedazo de venda.
I wrapped a bandage on it.
Continuamos trabajando.
And we kept working.
Camino del llano viene puntero en la soledad. Camino del llano viene puntero en la soledad. El cabrestero cantando a.
Te confieso que por mucho tiempo llegué a pensar que
And I must confess that I had pretty much concluded that for the rest of my life I'd be working in construction.
Pero un día me sorprendió cuando...
But then I met this lady who knew Joe. And she asked me, can I give your phone number to a friend of mine?
Él le gusta la música venezolana.
He likes Venezuelan music.
Claro, no hay problema.
Yeah, sure, no problem. When I met Larry, it was, you know, winter of 2021. And then I didn't know.
Like
what
a year and a half ago?
Yeah, the thing is, I didn't know what I was doing with my life. I was floating around, and the pandemic had completely decimated my operation and everything I had worked to build, and I was lost. So I met him, and I said, oh, that's it. The universe gave me an opportunity that I was not going to pass by this time. I don't think I've ever worked as hard as I've worked to learn this music.
Así nace el dúo Larry y yo.
And that's how the duo Larry and Joe was born.
¿Y sabes por qué nace?
And you know why it was born?
Porque cuando subimos a tarima juntos,
because when we got on stage for the first time,
que tocamos el primer tema,
we played the first song together,
todo el público se puso de pie.
They gave us a standing ovation.
Yo considero eso, como le he dicho a él, nuestra música, nuestro dúo es amor musical a primera vista.
And like I've told him many times, I consider our music, musical love at first sight.
Un, dos, tres, cuatro.
As you can hear, Larry also learned Joe's traditional music, bluegrass. He was finally able to quit his construction job in January of this year, and the duo is now touring the country full-time. Larry's asylum case is active and in process.
All across this country, from the east to the west, everywhere I go, I find the same old mess. Good-hearted people doing the best they can with a mucked-up system that don't give a damn. But I'll hold your hand if you...
That's Larry and Joe. They spoke with McLeet Hedero for our series Movement. If you want to hear more stories about music and migration, including a longer cut of this story, search for Movement wherever you listen to podcasts. The series is produced by Ian Koss and McLeet Hedero. That is where we leave things this Thursday. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler. See you back here tomorrow. And in the meantime, be good to each other out there.
All we need is change. Let our heels hit the pain.